was sorry to hear that about Brother Talkington. He's been a great encouragement to me for many years, and I will pray for him. The assignment we've been given this week has to do with the mysteries of the Bible, as you've already heard expressed. And the assignment for this morning is Mysteries of Daniel, that come from the book of Daniel. The word mystery in the Bible is a little confusing sometimes because it doesn't mean exactly what we mean by the word mystery in the English language. But it means that which is known to the initiated or can be known. Not something which is mysterious, but that which is outside the range of unassisted natural comprehension. This is what the Apostle Paul is referring to in the second chapter of the 1 Corinthian letter when he says that eye hath not seen nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. But God hath revealed them unto us by His Spirit. There are some things that we can't see by looking. There are some things we can't hear by listening. There are some things we can't meditate upon and figure out. And if God wants us to know those things, He must reveal them unto us. And that revelation is found in the Bible. There's lots of information that we can discover for ourselves that God did not feel it necessary to reveal to us. But things that He did want to reveal to us, He has placed between the covers of the Bible. And that's the area that we're talking about in the sense of mystery. In the ordinary sense, a mystery implies knowledge that's been withheld. But in Scripture, the scriptural significance of mystery is a truth that has been revealed or made known or manifested. These expressions are all used. Among the ancient Greeks, the mysteries were religious rites and ceremonies that were practiced by secret societies, into which anyone who desired might be received. Those who were initiated into these mysteries became possessors of a certain knowledge which was not imparted to the uninitiated. And so the word mystery is used in the Bible in a very similar sense to that. You're only going to get this revelation from God if you study the place where God has put this revelation. It's not going to come to you by any sort of personal epiphany in your own head. Now, as we look at the book of Daniel, we see that there is a great deal of prophetic information here. We start out in chapter 2, and there we find the backbone of biblical prophecies, really, because the four great world empires are revealed there prior to the time that three of them had even occurred. Thou art this head of gold, and then he goes down and Daniel explains to King Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of the dream that he had had, with those four great world empires being mentioned there. The Babylonian Empire burnt the idolatry out of the Jewish people. After they came back from Babylonian captivity, they were not guilty of idolatry anymore, at least for the most part. In the Old Testament, we find them running after idols time after time. But in the New Testament, I can't think of any time that the Son of God ever excoriated the Jews for their idolatry. And the Babylonian Empire was used to rid them of that. The Persian Empire sent them back. The temple was rebuilt. The Grecian Empire produced a lingua franca, a universal language that was very precise and had lots of distinctions between descriptive words, the perfect language for the New Testament to be written in, so that we could have the precision of God's word in the Greek language. And then the Roman Empire established a Pax Romana, a world without walls, in a sense, where the Apostle Paul, as a Roman citizen, could go from one country to another with no visa or passport, but he was taking the gospel over the roads that the empire itself had paved. So all of these empires had something to do for the people of God, did good things for the people of God, as well as sometimes doing bad things against the people of God. But this is the backbone of biblical prophecy in chapter 2. I don't know that we need to spend much time there. The book of Daniel is a book for every day and for all the tomorrows to come. What revelation is to the New Testament, the book of Daniel is to the Old. And it's one of the most fascinating books in the Bible, but not one of the easiest books. It naturally divides itself into two parts. The first six chapters talking about the prophet and his experiences, and then the last six chapters pretty much talking about his prophecies. There is some overlap between these two sections, but primarily this is the case. It has these two main parts. And it gives a panorama of the history that was to come with reference to the people of God and their connection to it. Just say a word about the book of Daniel itself. Practically all conservative scholars date the book of Daniel somewhere near 536 BC. But in other circles, this book has been viciously attacked as a forgery. This started no later than the 3rd century, when a philosopher by the name of Porphyry, who was probably the first significant unbelieving critic of the book of Daniel, around 233 AD, Porphyry wrote books against the Christians, and in those, he alleged that the book of Daniel was written by somebody living in Judea at the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, about 165 BC. According to Porphyry, predictive prophecy is just not possible, and therefore the book could not have been written before the events that it predicts. Never forget that the book of Daniel purports to have been written back at the time that Daniel was alive, and that's in the 6th and 7th centuries before Christ. If it was not written then statements like, "I, Daniel," could not be right, because Daniel didn't write them. That's when Daniel lived. So we have this modern critical view that's basically the same as Porphyry's was all those years ago, and it exists for the same reason: the assumption that predictive prophecy is impossible. What began as a very tentative guess many years ago has, by many repetitions, become an assumed fact on the part of many people in the biblical world of criticism. But the real reason for the attack is that man is taken to be the ultimate. Prophecies and miracles, therefore, are signs of supernatural power and cannot really occur. Now, Jesus diametrically opposes that. "Believe me for my very work's sake," and he's talking about his miracles in John 10:38. Also, he said, "Now I have told you before it come to pass, that when it is come to pass, that you might believe," John 14:29. He's talking about making predictive prophecies. Miracles and prophecies are two great proofs of God's power. The whole idea of demythologizing the Bible to make it just philosophy, and then you put a little religion sprinkled back in, is it has nothing to do, and you wind up with something that nobody knows really what it is. The modern religious world doesn't even seem to know what it's dealing with. They call it neo-orthodoxy, but nobody seems to even know what it is. It's like grape nuts. It's not grapes and it's not nuts, but what is grape nuts? I like it, but I don't know what's in there. It's like Christian Science. It's not Christian, it's not science, but nobody knows exactly what it is. Even Mary Baker Eddy didn't seem like she could really define it for sure. Karl Barth did not really believe in time, space, history, and religious things happening there. He had a sort of a super-duper history that nobody really understands. This is what you get into when you follow the line of modern criticism of the Bible, and in particular of the book of Daniel. Job said, it was said in the book of Job, chapter 11, verses 7 and 8, "Canst thou by searching find out God? Canst thou find out the Almighty unto perfection? It is as high as the heaven. What canst thou do? Deeper than Sheol. What canst thou know? Eye hath not seen nor ear heard." We need a revelation from God. And if God wants us to know these things that we can't see, hear, or figure out, then he has to reveal them to us. If the Bible is not God's word, then we don't have any word from God. And a lot of people are intent on destroying the Bible. If you want to destroy the Bible, the book of Daniel is a place to start, because it has predictive prophecies in it that are rather amazing. And if they are allowed to stand, then who can deny that the Bible came from a supernatural source? It could not have been produced just by man. We who believe in Jesus Christ understand that Jesus believed the book of Daniel and called Daniel a prophet. And that's good enough for us. J.R., I'm sorry, that's your boy. James Allen, do we want to get a mic to him or not? Oh, he's over here. I don't know if you need a mic or not. Are you? Okay, they're bringing a mic to you. Go ahead and we'll see how it happens.
What did the Jews believe concerning the book of Daniel?
They believed it was written when Daniel said it was, back in 536, right at the end of Daniel's life. This was believed up until the Christian era. Porphyry was the first one I know of that began to deny this in the 3rd century of the Christian era. Oh, you mean what do they believe now?
Yeah,
oh, well.
The Jews today, what do they believe?
Most Jews today don't believe the Bible at all. Like when I was taking a tour, my wife and I years ago were taking a tour through Temple B'nai Yehuda over in Kansas City. And we were on this tour, walking along here, and I asked the tour guide, do you believe the Old Testament? He said, no, we're not required to believe that here. And that's the way it is with most. In fact, one time I was in another Jewish establishment over on Knoll in Kansas City years ago, and I was sitting in the rabbi's office talking to him. I asked him, now, what do you do with the 9th chapter of Daniel? I'm sure you have an explanation for it, but I'd just like to know what it is. And he started looking around his office there, where he had all these walls lined with books, started looking around his office for a copy of the Hebrew Scriptures, and he couldn't even find one in his whole office, because that's not where his focus is. He's interested primarily in social-type things, making the world a better place, and this is the reason why the Reformed and some of the conservative Jews today can join hands with the Protestant denominations, because they believe basically the same thing, and that's nothing. Thank you. Yes, I should have said before we started that anytime you've got a question or a thought, please feel free to raise your hand. I have no idea what's going to happen in this class. Obviously, we're not going to cover everything in Daniel. It's a lot like going out to the mulberry tree with my grandchildren. I think it was last Sunday I got home from somewhere. I guess I'd been up to Excelsior Springs speaking at their weekend meeting. I came home to be welcomed in the loving arms of my little grandchildren, and they wanted to go out to the mulberry trees. It's been a good year for mulberries. We've got some nice mulberry trees growing out in the front yard, only because they didn't get mowed down. They were close enough to other things that the mower didn't catch them as it went by. And so they've grown up into big bushes where they almost meet together. And we've had a lot of rain this year, lots of nice warm weather as well, just perfect weather for raising mulberries. Well, there's something in me that likes to be systematic about things. I'd like to pick them all off this one branch and then the next branch and get them all big and small in a systematic way. But you just don't have time to do that. And with grandchildren, you're not about to do that. Oh, Grandpa, can you reach that one way up there, that big one? Well, there's hundreds up there. Which one are you talking about? Can you reach just that? That's the way I'm afraid our class today is going to be. I wish that we could start in verse 1 of the book of Daniel and just study it through in a systematic way. I think the book of Daniel rewards that kind of a study. But we're just looking here. It's not even really an overview. We're just going to be picking a mulberry here and a mulberry there, and you can have any say you want to on what mulberries we look at. We'll try to get the ladder out or reach down low or whatever we need to do to see if we can find somebody to help you pick that mulberry that you want. So I should have said at the beginning, and thank you, James Allen, for reminding me that if you have anything to say as we go along, be sure and bring it up. And if I don't see you, maybe one of these guys will that has the microphones. The context of the book of Daniel is that the people of God were being taken in three main captivities, into the captivity of the Babylonians to have the idolatry burnt out of them. Back 100 years before this, in Hezekiah's day, a bunch of Babylonians had visited Hezekiah, and Hezekiah had shown them everything in his house and his dominions. And Isaiah came to Hezekiah right after that and said, where were those guys from that were in here? And Hezekiah said, well, they're from a country way far off named Babylon. At the time, the Jews weren't thinking too much about those people. And Isaiah said, well, what did these men see in your house? And Hezekiah said, oh, they saw them, every treasure I've got. I didn't hide anything from them. Showed them where everything was. And that's when Isaiah made the prediction. And we find this recorded in the 39th chapter of the book of Isaiah, verse 6. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away. And they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. And as we read the first chapter of Daniel, that's exactly what is transpiring. That prophecy is being fulfilled. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego probably were all made into eunuchs. We never read of wives for these men. The people had not learned from the history of their past. They had not learned from what the Lord had said, and so they were taken into the Babylonian captivity. That's the original context of this book. this Neo-Babylonian empire that was led by Nebuchadnezzar. It only lasted for 70 years, and Nebuchadnezzar was the king of it for well over half of that. So thou art this head of gold. He was representative of the head of gold in the backbone of Bible history. Maybe that's enough of the historical background for this. If it's not, you can tell me. But we'd better start to look at some of these prophecies themselves. And I don't know exactly where to... It really is like being under the mulberry tree. You don't know exactly what to pick at. But I think maybe, since somebody asked me about the ninth chapter, maybe that would be a good place for us to start. The prophecy of the 70 weeks. If we had time, it would be good to start in the first verse and see that Daniel had been reading from the book of Jeremiah, and he prays a long prayer to the Lord, and there are lots of good and tasty little mulberries leading up to the actual prophecy itself. But I'm going to sort of assume a knowledge of the context on your part, and if we need to go back and fill in, we'll do that. Otherwise, I just want to read the prophecy itself that we find beginning down in verse 24, Daniel 9:24, because this was specifically asked about this week. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. Now this is God, through his angel, talking to Daniel. So thy people are the people of God. And he's making this prediction. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city, which was Jerusalem, to finish the transgression, and to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, and to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 70 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation. And that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate. Now, there's a lot here, but I would like to take this as systematically as we can, and I'll be as sketchy about it as I can. The first two words here are 70 weeks, which shows us that we're talking here about time. Many of these prophecies have to do with time and the measurement of time. And when we talk about time, It gets more complicated than we wish it was. Obviously, this passage, which talks about the coming of the Messiah, had to be precisely fulfilled. If it had not been precisely fulfilled, that would have given the first century Jews reason to reject Jesus Christ, because he hadn't fulfilled this prophecy. So it had to be precisely fulfilled. But it's up to us to determine what's being talked about here. First, he says 70 weeks, and a week is 7 days. 70 weeks, therefore, is 490 days. And in a place like this, it would seem that we need to apply the so-called day-year theory to the prophecy. You're familiar with the concept, I think, of symbolic language in prophecy. And if you're not, then please stop me and we'll go back and explain that. But symbolic language in prophecy means that one thing stands for another. Something that would be literally understood ordinarily is used, that word is used to describe something that it is symbolic of. Like in the seventh chapter, you have the lion and the bear and the leopard and the diverse beast that was unlike anything Daniel could find in the zoo, so he didn't even know what to call it. But you had those four beasts that showed the same thing in a little more detail that was shown back in Daniel 2. The things that the image meant in Daniel 2 are what's meant by those beasts in Daniel 7. The lion represents the Babylonian Empire. It's the same as the head of gold, for example. Now, the fact that a little lion could be used to represent a great empire shows what we mean by symbolic language. A little beast representing a big beast or an empire. When we take this concept of symbolic language over into time, it's natural then that a little piece of time would represent a big piece of time. And I think that's exactly what we have happening when we say that a day in prophetic language represents a year. I think most or many of you are familiar with this concept, but maybe we'd better nail this down just a bit more scripturally speaking. There is scriptural precedent for this. In the first place, back in the 14th chapter of the book of Numbers, about the 34th verse there, we find that the 12 spies that went into the promised land to spy out the land and see whether the children of Israel should go in and take it or not, whether the children of Israel should obey what the Lord said about going in and taking it, they went and spied out the land for 40 days. And they came back, and as you know, 10 of them gave an evil report. Only Joshua and Caleb said otherwise. And so the crowd went with the majority and said, we can't possibly take this land. Well, as a result of that, their punishment was that that generation did not get to go into the promised land, but you shall wander in the wilderness for 40 years, each year for a day that you had to spy out the promised land. You had 40 days to look it over and figure out how to take it with my help. And since you declined to do that, now you're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years because you were there for 40 days. 40 years until this generation dies off, and maybe the next generation will be better at obeying what I say. So that establishes the concept behind the day, the so-called day-year theory. I don't even like it to call it a theory because I think it's an established fact. But in prophetic circles, it's often called the day-year theory, and a lot of people don't believe in it. Even more conclusive, perhaps, than that would be the fourth chapter of the book of Ezekiel, verse 6. You remember the story where Ezekiel was told to make a little tile representing the city of Jerusalem, and then he was to lay siege against it in a symbolic way. He was supposed to go out and lay on the ground on one side for so many days, and then lay on his other side, laying siege to this city for so many days. And each day that he would lay on his side would represent a year. And the Lord specifically said to him, I have given you each day for a year, in Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6. This establishes the principle behind the day-year theory. And as far as I'm concerned, the ninth chapter of Daniel itself proves the day-year theory, because if the day-year theory is not true, then we're only talking about 70 literal weeks here. And if we're talking about 70 literal weeks, all these things that are being predicted verse 24 through the end of the chapter, these things didn't all happen in 70 literal weeks. 70 weeks literally is not even 2 years. These things did not happen that are mentioned that we just read. They didn't happen in 2 years. They took not 490 days, but they took 490 years to occur. So to me, the ninth chapter of Daniel just by itself shows the validity of the day-year application. Each day for a year. So these first two words of the prophecy then, 70 weeks, indicate 490 days in the prophecy, which would transfer to 490 years in our understanding of the prophecy. He's talking about 490 years. They are determined upon thy people and upon the holy city, the city of Jerusalem, to finish the transgression and to do these other things. Now, when we talk about this 490-year period of time, it's rather easy to find when the end of that is if we can just find when the beginning of it is. So that needs to focus our attention. If we can find the place to begin it, then just laying it out and seeing when everything happens should be relatively easy. But we've got to find the right place to begin it, and that's very important to do. Nothing could be more important at this juncture than to find the right place to begin. And I don't mind telling you, the same lady that recommended that we start with the ninth chapter in our considerations today said that every time I've heard the ninth chapter of Daniel taught, it just seems like the teacher is fudging the dates to get it to come out the way he wants it to. And you may have that same feeling, either externally pronounced or hidden within your heart. You may feel like we play fast and loose with these dates sometimes to get them to come out the way that we want them to. Well, I don't want you to leave here this morning with that kind of a feeling about this. I don't want to fudge the dates. I want to do it the best we can with the dates. But if I'm going to try to overcome the objection of having fudged the date, then I need to tell you why I select the date that I do. And to tell you that, it takes some explanation. And to explain this is not going to be very interesting to some of you. And that's the dilemma we're up against here. So I'll play this by ear. We'll do the best we can with it, and you let me know how we're doing. I'm apologizing before I do it. I'll probably apologize while I'm doing it, and I'll apologize at the end, because I know it's not the cup of tea of many, probably not even the majority of you, and yet, if we're going to see where these dates come from, and you're going to halfway believe that I didn't just suck it out of my thumb, then I feel like I need to explain it somehow. So this is the best I know how to do. We're trying to date this from the command to restore and to build Jerusalem. That's what he says down here in verse 25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 70 weeks and 2 weeks, and then later he talks about another week, which would be the 70th week or the last week. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublous times. So that's what we're dating from, if we can just find that commandment. We know what commandment we're looking for. It's the commandment to restore and to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. They had one holy city, and that was the city of Jerusalem. So which decree are we talking about? Now, there were at least four decrees, four edicts given, or at least four allowances for various people to go back and do something. And to be a little bit thorough about this, we actually need to look at these decrees, if you don't mind doing that, because I have seen various ones of these decrees selected as the one from which to date. And I don't know why people select the decree that they select, unless they tell me. I only know why I select the one that I select, and I'll try to explain that to you as we go along. But maybe the first thing to do is to look at these decrees as briefly as we can, but yet we need to read them so that you can see, as we read a decree, is this a decree to restore and to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, or is it a decree about something else? First place we need to go for the first one of these decrees is the first chapter of Ezra. Ezra chapter 1, and I'll just read a couple of verses there. Ezra chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. Here's the first decree, and this is made just shortly after the Babylonian Empire has been taken over by the Persian Empire. That happened in 539, and in 536, Cyrus sends the pioneers back for a specific purpose. Remember, it wasn't a whole bunch of them that went back. 42,360 plus some of their helpers for a combined total of around 50,000 people was all that went back. But they went back on the basis of this decree. Listen to it. Ezra 1, verse 2. Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord God of heaven hath given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he hath charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem. Build me a house at Jerusalem, says God. That's the temple. This is a decree to go back and rebuild the temple, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? His God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord. He's not talking about building the city of Jerusalem. He's not talking about building the walls of the city of Jerusalem. He's talking about building the temple back. The temple has been destroyed in 586 BC by the Babylonians. It's gone. And it's the most important piece of architecture that used to be in the city of Jerusalem. This is about putting that back there, doing first things first, getting that back there before you do anything else. Build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is the God which is in Jerusalem. And whoever remaineth in any place where he is, sojourneth, where he sojourneth, let the men of his place help him with silver and with gold and with goods and with beasts, besides the freewill offering for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. It's a decree about rebuilding the temple. What did we find in Daniel 9:25? Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem, the streets shall be built again, even the wall, and the wall, even in troublous times. So I conclude that the one we just read from about 536 B.C. is not the one that we're looking for. Let's go on to the next one. This one takes place under Darius Hystaspes about 20 years later in the sixth chapter of the book of Ezra. Ezra chapter 6, and I'm going to go down there and read just a few verses, starting in verse 6. Ezra 6, verse 6. Watch and see if there's anything in here about rebuilding Jerusalem or anything that pertains to that. Now therefore, Tachnai, governor beyond the river, Shethar Bozni and your companions, the Apharsachites, which are beyond the river, be it far from thence. Let the work of this house of God alone. See, this is only 20 years after the other decree. The temple was begun at an earlier time, but now it has fallen into disrepair. There's sagebrush growing up around the foundations of it, and there's nobody working on the temple. So this is to encourage the people to do what the first decree encouraged them to do. Let the work of this house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God in his place. Moreover, I make a decree what ye shall do to the elders of these Jews for the building of this house of God, that of the king's goods, even of the tribute beyond the river, that's the Euphrates, forthwith expenses be given unto these men, that they be not hindered. And that which they have need of, both young bullocks and rams and lambs, for the burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, and oil, according to the appointment of the priests which are at Jerusalem, let it be given them day by day without fail, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet savors unto the God of heaven, and pray for the life of the king and for his sons. Also I have made a decree that whosoever shall alter this word, let timber be pulled down from his house, and being set up, let him be hanged thereon, and let his house be made a dunghill for this. And the Lord that hath caused his name to dwell there, destroy all kings and people that shall put their hand to alter and destroy this house of God, which is at Jerusalem. I, Darius, have made a decree, let it be done with speed. This is like a reiteration or a reenactment of the first decree that was made 20 years earlier, and has nothing to do with rebuilding the city of Jerusalem itself. Nothing about this that could be said, the streets shall be built and the wall, even in troublous times. Let's go to a third one then, in the next chapter, Ezra chapter 7. Although it's just the next chapter from where we were reading, there is a 58-year interval in between chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra. In that 58-year interval, the book of Esther happens and a whole bunch of other things happen. So there's quite a different scene, quite a different stage of history here, just from the 6th to the 7th chapter of the book of Ezra. It's not immediately apparent when you just see it printed out in the Bible. Well, we've got another king here now. His name is Artaxerxes I. Some people call him Longimanus. Artaxerxes Longimanus. He's known as Longimanus. The word Longimanus apparently means long hands, because they say that this man had such long hands. You know, when you study the history of kings, I don't know if it's genetically determined or how it was, but there's a lot of weird physical specimens in the kingships of nations. And they say that this man's hands, when he stood up straight, he could touch his kneecap because his hands were so long. He could touch his kneecaps just with the tips of his fingers. So he was called Long Hands, and he's going to be very important in our discussion. Artaxerxes Longimanus. This particular decree in chapter 7 takes place in his 7th year. And I need to read this. I don't know how much of it to read, but I'll give you a taste of it anyway. In Ezra chapter 7, verse 12. Artaxerxes, king of kings, unto Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of God of heaven, of the God of heaven, perfect peace, and at such a time, which was their way of saying, and so forth, or etc. I make a decree that all they of the people of Israel and of his priests and Levites in my realm, which are minded of their own free will to go up to Jerusalem, go with thee. Now this is Ezra being sent back. Zerubbabel's already been sent back to restore the temple. Now Ezra's being sent back. What's he going to restore? Go with thee. For as much as thou art sent of the king and of his 7 counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of thy God, which is in thine hand, and to carry silver and gold, which the king and his counselors have freely offered unto the God of Israel, whose habitation is in Jerusalem, and all the silver and gold that thou canst find in all the province of Babylon, with the freewill offering of the people and of the priest, offer willingly for the house of their God, which is in Jerusalem, that thou mayest buy speedily with this money bullocks, rams, lambs, and their meal offerings and their drink offerings, and offer them upon the altar of the house of your God, which is in Jerusalem. And whatsoever shall seem good to thee and to thy brethren to do with the rest of the silver and gold, that do after the will of your God. The vessels also which were given thee for the servants of God, the house of thy God, those deliver before them, before the God of of Jerusalem. And whatsoever more shall be needful for the house of thy God, which thou shalt have occasion to bestow, bestow it out of the king's treasure house. And I, even I, Artaxerxes the king, do make a decree to all the treasures that are beyond the river, that whatsoever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of the God of heaven, shall require of you, it be done speedily. Unto 100 talents of silver, 100 measures of wheat, 100 baths of wine, 100 baths of oil, and salt, without prescribing how much. Whatsoever is commanded by the God of heaven, let it be diligently done for the house of the God of heaven. For the house of the God of heaven. We're still talking about the temple here. And why should there be wrath against the realm of the king and his sons? Well, he goes on and talks more about the Levites, the singers, the Nethinim, the ministers of the house of God. I won't read all of that, but there's nothing here about restoring the city of Jerusalem. Ezra went back primarily to restore the law, and he did that. And he also had to do with the things that were going on at the house of God, the temple there, which was finished in 516, just exactly 70 years after it had been destroyed. The temple of God was finished, it was completed in 516 BC. This is all about the law of God, its restoration, and the house of God, the restoration, the vessels, the offerings, the sacrifices that went along with that. So we've read 3 decrees, and we still haven't found what's talked about in Daniel 9:25. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks and then another week for the total of the 70 weeks. So let's look at another one. This also is under the reign of Artaxerxes Longimanus, and it's recorded in Nehemiah. You'll be more familiar with this one, perhaps, or more of you will be familiar with this one, perhaps, than the others that we have read, because this is often used in stories with children when we talk about the story of Nehemiah. Let me just read maybe the first 8 verses here of Nehemiah chapter 2, and you'll recognize the story very well. It came to pass in the month of Nisan, which is also called Abib, and is somewhat similar to our month of April, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine. This is Nehemiah writing, he was the king's cupbearer, and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before time sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing that thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid. And I said to the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad? Why should not my countenance be sad? When the city, the place of my father's sepulchre, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire. Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? So I prayed unto the God of heaven, and I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. That's what we're talking about. That I may build the city of Jerusalem. That's what Daniel 9:25 said. So that's what we're talking about here. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be? And when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Nehemiah was systematic, he was organized, he set a time that he would be back by if the king would allow him to go and do this work. Moreover, I said unto the king, verse 7, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come into Judah. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace which appertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city. Now we're talking. That sounds like Daniel 9. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times. Now he's looking for lumber to use to build the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. So I believe in Nehemiah chapter 2, we have found the decree that's being spoken of in Daniel chapter 9. Let me read verse 24 and 25 again. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, says verse 24, and 25 says, know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be this period of time, this 490-year period of time that we're talking about. He splits it up into 3 different categories. So we've read 4 decrees. I have to go with the one in Nehemiah 2, where Nehemiah is being sent back to restore the city walls and to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. That's what Nehemiah asked to go do, and that's what the king said that he could go do. So it seems to be the only one of the four edicts that meets the requirements of the prophecy. At least it seems so to me. Now, mine may be a minority view on this. I don't know. There probably are other people here who do not agree with this, but this is the way it looks to me. So, if this is the decree, then we know when to start that 490 years. Well, we almost know. We know that it's in, as it was said here, the 20th year of Artaxerxes Longimanus. If we can determine what is the 20th year of Artaxerxes Longimanus, then we know exactly where to start the 490 years, and then it'll just be up to whatever happens where it comes out, because once we pin it down and start it, then we're not going to fudge that date. We've got to leave that there, and whatever it turns out to be in the end, no matter how confusing it is, we can't mess with this original date. This is why it's so important to pinpoint this original date. We have pinpointed it, at least to my satisfaction, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes Longimanus. And now the question becomes, what is the 20th year of Artaxerxes Longimanus? And here it starts to get complicated. And this is what I was apologizing about before. You may have thought I was apologizing about what I've said so far. That's not what I was apologizing about, really. I'm apologizing about what I'm about to say. Because here, when we try to determine what is the 20th year of Artaxerxes Longimanus, it's not an uncomplicated discussion. I could try to make it seem uncomplicated, but then you wouldn't really know where I got the date. So we need to go down through the valleys as well as just from one mountaintop to another here to try to do this. And it has to do with chronology. When we're dealing with time, time is a very complicated issue. And as Americans, we like, in many cases, to be sort of precise about time. Sometimes I think we're more precise about time now than people were even in Bible times. In Bible times, they didn't have an atomic watch on their wrist like I do. This watch gets signals from Boulder, Colorado that keeps it just exactly right. I've only had it a few years, and for the first time in my life, I know what time it really is. It's getting late here, later than I wanted it to get. But, you know, just a few years ago, people did not, if they had a clock, they didn't have a minute hand on it. There was a clock with one hand, and when it was sort of pointing toward the number, then that was good enough. Just a few years ago, noon in your town was when the sun was directly overhead in your town. We didn't have time zones. We didn't need time zones. When there was nothing faster than a horse, who needs a time zone? You're not going to get anywhere that quick anyway. So it'll be in the next town you eventually come to, when the sun is overhead there, it'll be noon also. The idea of time zones was unthought of until Magellan circumnavigated the globe. Well, he didn't. He got killed in the Philippines. But some of his crew made it back to Europe. And when they came back to Europe after going around the world, they found they were a day off and nobody could figure it out. The people that had been on this ship said, well, I know, I kept track of it every day. And the people in Europe said, well, we kept track of time too, and you're a day off. And they finally figured out that they were a day off because they'd gone around the world. And that's when we started really thinking about the measurement of time and all the ramifications of this. And that's why we have an international dateline out in the Pacific Ocean. So this gets to be a complicated discussion when we're talking about the measurement of time. And I'm very sorry to have to say to you, because I wish it were otherwise, that we don't have an absolute chronology. When it comes to measuring the time and the dates that things happened, you and I do not possess an absolute chronology. We never have had one, and we're never going to have one while we're here on the earth. That's just the sad fact of it. Now, over the past 40 years or so, I've probably investigated as many as 40 different chronologies, and I've never found one that is absolute. There are problems with all of these. You may look at chronologies and you may develop a standard chronology. You may come up with a chronology you like. But a chronology is like a commentary. A commentary can lock you into places that you shouldn't even be because it sounds good. It looks good on the face of it. And I've known people who read commentaries. They read a particular commentary when they were young and impressionable. They got locked into a particular point of view on things. And that doesn't change when they're 70 or 80 years old because they read that commentary. There's nothing wrong with a commentary. What I'm saying now is oral commentary. That's all that it is. But I'm just saying that a chronology is much like that. And the reason I'm stressing this is because if you see this on a nice colorful chart and the dates are all there and it's plasticized and it's permanent, it's easy to think, well, this if this says 464 or 465, then that must be what it is because that's what the chart said. The problem is that the chart is just a standard, but the chart is not absolute. And the chart was made by men, and those men were not inspired, and they have to make assumptions. That's the problem. The easiest way to see what I'm talking about here is to try to make your own chronology. Maybe you ought to try that sometime, to make a chronology of Old Testament history. Because all comprehensive chronologies are based on assumptions. And at some point, it'll be sooner rather than later, at some point you're going to come to a fork in the road, making your chronology, and you're going to have to go one way or the you'll have three choices. You take one fork or you take the other fork, or you just stop trying to make a chronology. Because if you're going to make a chronology, you have to come up with a date. You may put a question mark after it, but you're going to come up with a date. And the evidence is not always beyond a reasonable doubt. And unfortunately, sometimes the preponderance of the evidence even is a little difficult to determine. So when you see somebody's chronology in color and official looking, take it with a healthy skepticism. Things are very often not as clear-cut as they might be made to appear. And it's easy for the most honest, well-intentioned researcher to miss the mark. It's easy then to take a created mistake that you don't know is a mistake, but take somebody's mistake that they have created and use that, and every time you use that mistake, you're creating other mistakes in your conclusions. There are all sorts of issues involved here. There are calendric issues. There are source issues. And either one of these is huge. Just the calendric issues are huge. When you talk about calendars, this is not a static issue at all. The Jews, for example, used a lunar calendar that was based on months, based on what the moon was doing. And unfortunately, the moon is not precisely in sync with the sun. I mean, it's working how it's supposed to, but as far as the measurement of time, they're two different things. You can use both of them in concert and come out very well. But we didn't know how to do that for a long time. So the Jews used lunar calendars, and since they would get out of sync with the sun so quickly, every once in a while they would add an extra year in with a certain number of days so that they could stay up with the sun. Well, this is why Julius Caesar came along with his so-called Julian calendar back even before the time of Christ. He abolished the lunar year and all those extra months, and he regulated the year using only the sun. And Julius Caesar, way back before Christ, he came up with the idea, or his astronomers did, of using 3 years of 365 days and then 1 year of 366 days, much the same way that we do now. And it was called the Julian calendar, and it was pretty good. But to get back in track with the sun, they had to make 1 year, for instance, 46 B.C. They took the year 46 B.C., and you know how long it was? 46 B.C. was 445 days long. It was called the year of confusion by the Romans, because you can imagine how confusing that would be, to have a year that's 445 days long. I mean, what do you then call last year? What do you call next year? It just gets very, very confusing. And yet, if we want to stay in sync with the sun, we have to bite the bullet and do these things occasionally, or we have had to in the past. The solar year itself is 365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes, and 45.975 seconds long. The difference between what we do, what we have with our calendar now, or the difference between the Julian calendar and the way the sun works is 11 minutes and 14 seconds. There's 11 minutes and 14 seconds different between a real solar year at the equator and what we have with a year in the Julian calendar. So that's pretty good to only be 11 minutes off. But the trouble is that time continues on. And if you use the Julian calendar long enough, once again, you're out of sync with the sun. And so we had to develop the Gregorian calendar later on, named after Pope Gregory XIII. In 1582, this came about because in the Julian calendar, there's a one-day error for every 128 years. Doesn't matter just during your lifetime, but over the centuries, it began to matter. They began to get off. And this is the calendar that we use today, the Gregorian calendar, which was a correction of the Julian calendar. Gregory XIII eliminated 10 days in the Catholic countries, at least. Those were the ones that he had jurisdiction over. In the Catholic countries, generally speaking, the day after October the 4th, 1582, was October the 15th, 1582. They left out 10 days. in the Catholic countries. And they also said that every year ending in two zeros, which cannot be evenly divided by 400, is not a leap year. This is why 1700 was not a leap year. 1800 was not a leap year. 1900 was not a leap year. 2000 was a leap year because it can be evenly divided by 400. It's complicated, but it helps us keep right in sync with the sun, and that's what we're after. The Gregorian calendar is only 26 seconds longer than the solar year, so this should last us for another 1,000 years or so before we have to mess with it. You and I won't have to worry about it. By the way, in the Protestant countries, including the American colonies, where we're sitting right now, they didn't change to the Gregorian calendar until 1752. The British Empire changed and the Protestant countries in general changed. The day in our nation, what was going to become our nation, it was done in 1752. The day after September 2nd, 1752, in America, was September the 14th, 1752. We left out 11 days because we had neglected the Pope's correction for long enough that we had to leave out 11 days when he only left out 10 days back in the 16th century. So we had to leave out 11 days. And it just creates chaos. How do you teach your children about that? Well, honey, we're going to leave out 11 days now. What? You know, they're not going to grasp this. It just convolutes everything when they left out 11 days. Landlords were trying to charge rent for the whole month. Renters were saying, no way that's going to happen. I didn't get 11 days of that month. George Washington was born on February 11th, 1732. But we celebrate his birthday, or at least we used to, on February 22nd. On February 22nd of every year because of the 11-day gap. That's why you have old style and new style. What I'm saying to you is that there's nothing static about a calendar. They can be changed all the time. They can be changed at people's whims. They can be changed to try to correct them. They can be changed for other reasons just because somebody came to power. And when we look back historically and we try to deal with these calendars and make sense of stretches of time, it gets to be more complicated than I wish it was. I wish it wasn't this way, but we have to face it. Those are just the calendric issues that we face. There are also source issues that we face, and the source issues are even worse, I'm afraid, than the calendric issues are. I was thinking of giving you a chart. Actually, I wanted you to have three charts, but I realized if there are 300 of you in this class, for me to give you these three charts that I really wanted you to have would cost me about $1,800 so that each of you could have $6 worth of charts. And I thought some of you maybe weren't interested enough for me to spend $1,800 on charts for you. So I don't have a chart for you, and I don't have a blackboard. And so we're just going to have to try to think together about this as we try to determine what the 20th year of Artaxerxes Longimanus is. To determine his 20th year, we have to determine when Artaxerxes Longimanus came into power. And if I had given you that chart, you would see that the year for the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus on that chart is the standard date that's used and accepted in almost all circles, and that is 464 BC for the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus. Now that date comes from the canon of Ptolemy. This is the same Ptolemy that had a fixed earth and thought the heavenly spheres were all moving around, including the sun, that ruled over Europe for 14 centuries, even though prior to his time, they had believed in the Copernican system, basically, that we believe in now. But for about 14 centuries, they went back to this thing that Ptolemy gave them, which looks at the world as it appears from planet Earth. This same Ptolemy had what's called Ptolemy's canon, which is just a list of kings. And in this list of kings, there are dates given. On the other hand, James Usher, who did a lot of work in chronology, James Usher set aside Ptolemy's date for the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus in favor of a different date, 473 BC, that's based on much older historical data, which Usher considered to be more reliable. Now, to my knowledge, all chronologists agree that King Xerxes, this is the same as Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther, King Xerxes came to the Persian throne around 486 BC, and they all agree that Artaxerxes Longimanus died around 424 BC or 423 BC. The only thing in dispute is that middle date, the day when Artaxerxes Longimanus ascended to the throne. And we need to talk about that just a little bit, if you will pardon me, in our second hour. We're going to need to talk about that just a little bit, and I think we can get to a what I consider to be a preponderance of the evidence on this issue and find a good date for the accession of Artaxerxes Longimanus. And once we've established that, we'll be able to see what his 20th year is. And when we see his 20th year, then we can immediately lay out the whole Daniel timetable. In fact, you can do that yourself. I might not even need to talk about that part. Well, there'll be three other chronological issues we'll have to talk about at that point. But pretty much when we set this up, then the whole thing becomes clearer immediately. So we'll begin our second hour with just a few minutes talking about the difference between Usher and Ptolemy's canon and why there is a difference there. I can't ask for questions now because I've run the time out, but maybe we should begin the second hour with questions. You're excused for 30 minutes. Thank you.